Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
That counts. Location information at BordersStores.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. By now, whether they want to or not, nearly everyone knows the national terrorism threat level has been bumped from yellow to orange, high alert. But what does that really mean this time? Officials are saying they are concerned about the possibility of not just one September 11th-style coordinated attack, but also about the potential for a series of smaller, isolated terrorist strikes. Credible intelligence, they say, points to threats to the usual big city targets, but also to a host of less glamorous but no less important sites, Alaskan oil facilities, nuclear power plants, dams, chemical plants. Maybe most disturbing of all, more than 2 years after 9/11, is the amount of intelligence that points to the use of airplanes, again, as detonators of mass destruction. In this holiday season, we don't want to hear it. It could be wrong. Americans fear being manipulated, but the fear in official circles appears to be real. This is new ground we're walking on, and options are limited tonight on Point. What's going on behind the orange alert? How are you processing the warnings from Washington? Are you changing channels and bored? Are you suspicious? Are you obsessed? How do we judge how much reaction to threats is too much and how much is too little? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We begin in Washington tonight. Josh Myers covers terrorism for the Los Angeles Times. His piece in today's Times, based on interviews with security and White House officials, can be fairly described as scary. Good evening and welcome, Josh Meyer.
Hi.
Thanks for being with us, Josh. You're quoting people today saying that federal officials, security officials, are wigging out over the volume and kind of ferocity, I guess, of intelligence pointing at a potential attack. How high is the fear level?
Well, I think that's a pretty apt term for it. I wasn't sure if you said the veracity or the ferocity of
ferocity. I said,
but actually, both are fairly apropos. I'm a veteran of this now. I guess I've covered five orange alerts. And what they're saying this time, interestingly enough, is that this really is an orange alert, I guess, as opposed to the others that might have been sort of light orange or something. But no, they're very, very concerned. As several of them said, it's what they don't know that concerns them. In other words, they don't know what they don't know.
But the don't know we always hear about, and it seems so obtuse. Reading your article this morning, it seems that last Thursday and Friday, some kind of bundle of intelligence flopped into view that seemed very concrete, very concerning. And as you say, this is not pale orange. I think you've even said this is burnt umber. That's verging on red.
Well, I think we said that in the discussion. We didn't write that it was burnt umber because, I mean, it's a very serious issue. And yes, even though I said that they don't know what they don't know, they did receive very specific intelligence, much of it from intercepted electronic communications, phone calls and emails and so on from known terrorist operatives overseas, in which they were discussing what they believed to be very specific and quote-unquote spectacular attacks. A lot of it has to do with the language, as was the case right before September 11th, 2 years ago. There's a lot of talk about like an upcoming big event and how we're finally going to strike back at the infidels and so on and so forth. So while they don't have the specificity in terms of a place and a time, they do believe they have much specificity and corroborated specificity with regard to planned attack.
We hear a lot about so-called chatter. I think people are almost tired of hearing about chatter. It sounds like chaff. But here you're writing about what you call expectant chatter, that is anticipating something coming. And you write about it, the concern being at two levels, one being the big urban targets and the other being much more diffuse array of potential targets. Give us a sense of what people are seeing there.
Well, I mean, New York and Washington, D.C. Have always been targets for al-Qaeda. Obviously, they've struck at both locations. Los Angeles is also a target in the sense that al-Qaeda in the past has shown that they very much want to finish the job and strike back at targets that they have not been successful at hitting. Like the first World Trade Center attack was in 1993. 10 years later, they struck again. They tried to – there was a plot to blow up LAX. or part of it.
Los Angeles Airport.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that was stopped in its tracks, and so that there's a lot of concern that they might try to do the same thing again. But there's also concern over cities like Las Vegas, which they consider the sort of evil, the den of iniquity of the United States, but also parts of the critical infrastructure like power plants and nuclear plants. And in fact, we reported today that Valdez, Alaska, is on the list of places that they believe are being targeted or might be targeted. And that is, of course, where the Transcontinental Pipeline, the Alaska Pipeline, offloads. So there's a lot of concern pretty much all around the country, and they're not sure that it's one attack or many attacks or several related attacks.
Josh Meyer, you describe the number of orange alerts that there have been to this point. As you say, this is maybe your fifth, and the quality of what you're hearing is different. Americans are responding in all kinds of ways. You know, some just can't be bothered to listen or pay attention. Others want to block it out. Others are obsessed. Others are skeptical about the whole thing. We're moving into a political season, and I've heard any number of times people saying, well, are we being played here? Let's go straight at that. You're speaking directly with people who are close to, I guess, the intelligence. Do you see room for manipulation on any side here? I mean, clearly there's, well, from the terrorist side, from Washington side?
Well, I mean, I hear a lot of people saying that they're just trying to cover their rear ends, as it were, by saying, well, there could be something happening that way. If there is, they've at least warned us. And that might have been the case on occasion in the past, but for reasons that I'm not still entirely sure of this time, they are freaking out. There's something going on that they don't want to tell us about. Because for obvious reasons, I mean, they don't want to be too specific. A lot of it's classified, and a lot of it they just don't know exactly. But I can tell you that they are very, very scared about this. I know people that didn't sleep over the weekend trying to figure out what to do about it. There was a unanimity among top officials about going to Code Orange, where in the past there were some pretty knockdown, drag-out arguments over whether to do it among FBI, Justice Department, Pentagon, Homeland Security officials. Because, you know, it costs hundreds of millions of dollars every time they go to Code Orange because of deployments of local law enforcement. So in this case, what I was told was that it was unanimous and very quick that they said, we have to go to Code Orange right away. So
really, really no debate this time. And, of course, it's expensive to do it, but it's also expensive if something happens. You cite critical infrastructure facilities potentially being targeted that
right.
could result in a devastating effect on the economy. And you cite... report that thousands of federal, state, and local agents have been dispatched to potential targets around the country to defend them, and not just in major urban areas.
Right. Well, I mean, by agents, I mean local law enforcement, police, and so on as well. I mean, people that were already in those locations. Every state and local government was asked to compile a list of what they believed to be vulnerable targets, and that was sent to Homeland Security over the past year. And then this list that they're circulating now is sort of a winnowed down list of that. It's comparing that list with the threats that they've been receiving to see what they think they need to protect first and foremost. I mean, and there's a lot of targets out there. I mean, I remember shortly after 9/11, I was going to do a story about how chlorine tanks were very vulnerable and that if you hit one of those with a rocket-propelled grenade, you could kill hundreds of thousands of people. I decided not to do that story because I didn't want to give them the good idea to do it and, you know, have a Bhopal-type disaster like the one in India. And, of course, somebody else, you know, a few months later ended up doing the same story. But there's a lot of things that could really cause a lot of trouble, dams, even cyber terror.
So many possibilities, so much unease and so much skepticism and uncertainty about even now how exactly to respond to this among ordinary citizens, intellectually, emotionally, in terms of preparedness. Josh Meyer, we're glad you're with us. Please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Washington David Heyman. He's director of the Homeland Security Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Good evening and welcome, David Heyman.
Hi.
Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. You've paid a lot of attention to scenarios and realities of potential terrorist threats over the last couple of years, have done gaming where you look at how things might unfold if and when there was a serious threat. First of all, what are you making of what you're hearing since the orange alert came up on Sunday, David Heyman?
Well, I think it is the increasing of the level of threat is significant this time. One of the reasons is the direct discussions with people in operations, people who are responsible for manning the emergency operations centers or in the federal government who are enhancing our protective measures from, you know, the military and to the Department of Homeland Security.
They're going to the bunkers this time. They're taking it
they
seriously.
They have all been in the bunkers since this weekend, and euphemistically, I guess, they're not the bunkers. These are command and control centers mm-hmm. for managing our operational response. And they have been in these facilities since the weekend, and they can't talk about it. It's, you know, the threat is classified, but they are taking this very seriously, and that's one thing to look at. The other thing to look at is, as Josh mentioned, we've been through this the going to code orange. We've gone up. This is the fourth time this year. Mm-hmm. It's the fifth time in a year, but we went up three times in 4 months at the beginning of the year, around the time that we were going to war with Iraq. And during that period of time, we had one event where Code Orange lasted for about 4 weeks. In that period of time, everybody has to go up to their enhanced protective measures, the cities, the states, and the federal government. And that's, as we talked about earlier, that's an extremely costly undertaking.
We've heard estimates of up to $1 billion every time the country has to do that.
Yeah, and that may be understating it, but that, you know, depending upon how you count it, I think it's hard to account for these types of things. But the point of it is that it presents huge burdens on the cities. The states are right now challenged because they've got shortfalls in their budgets. They may be, in some instances, operating at their full capacity. They don't have additional resources. And so when you raise the level, you're talking about asking them to go to double shifts, triple shifts, or whatever it may be.
But David Heyman, I want to go straight to this point, if I may. There's so many thoughts about this tonight. But the threat seems so broad to the ordinary citizen that sometimes there's a sense of Keystone Cops when it comes. You know, we see suddenly police with guard dogs here and there, and suddenly, I don't know, some guys with some rifles by a bridge in Boston, a big gas tanker ship kept out of the harbor. But it's a lot all over the place. Is it focused enough? Is it being are the defenses being put up against specific threats, or you know, is it just generalized on your toes, and is that effective?
Well, there are specific protective measures that are automatically put in place, but they're against generic threats. Until you have specific intelligence about where the threat might be, you cannot put in specific countermeasures. The reality is that because we don't know necessarily the specifics of where they might attack or when they might attack or how, we have to ratchet up our capabilities across the board, which means enhanced visibility as well as protective measures across critical assets, such as the 800-plus key assets across the country that Josh mentioned. We have to put in place enhanced highway patrols, truck stops, increased inspection capabilities. Coast Guard escorts are put into place. We've got in Washington, D.C. now missile protection.
And all this is going on right now.
This is all going on right now. It's actually part of the standard response now to a Code Orange.
And you look very closely at this. David Heyman, do you think that this cumulative effort can provide defense? Is it effective? Can it be?
Well, yes, it can, in fact. There's a couple of reasons it can provide defense. First of all, since we don't know what we're up against, putting in protective measures and increases awareness across the board and recognizing things. Remember 9/11, there was suspicious activity on a number of occasions with some of the hijackers, and had we had the awareness at the time, perhaps we would have looked at a traffic stop a little bit more seriously, as it was the case in two accounts. It also puts into place operations that may disrupt the terrorist networks. There are reports, of course, that the watch list that we now use for keeping people outside of the country mm-hmm. who might be suspicious, we have now stopped and prevented several individuals from coming into the country in the last few weeks.
So the net is up and it may be working. We have to take a short break. We are talking tonight about what's going on behind the orange alert. about the alarming holiday terror threat and details of the national response. I'm joined tonight by David Heyman with the Center for Strategic and International Studies and Josh Meyer. He covers terrorism for the Los Angeles Times. You can join us, too. How are you processing the latest high alert for terror? Are you changing channels or obsessed? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about what's going on behind the orange alert about the holiday terror threat and details of the national response. I'm joined tonight from Washington by David Heyman. He's director of the Homeland Security Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. From Los Angeles, or Washington, excuse me, by Josh Meyer. He covers terrorism for the Los Angeles Times. You can join us as well. How do you take on board reports of government officials wigging out over the current terror threat level? And how do we judge how much reaction to threats is too much, how much is too little? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We are joined now from Alexandria, Virginia, by James Gilmore. He's the former governor of Virginia, head of the Gilmore Commission, an advisory panel created in 1998 to assess domestic response capabilities to terrorism involving weapons of mass destruction. The commission is reporting to Congress, and the president came in with its big report just last week. Very happy to have with us former Governor James Gilmore. Welcome.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for the chance to talk to your listeners.
It's great to have you, Governor. You just came in with the fruit of your several years' labor last week, pointing out areas where terrorism protection could be better, bringing up concerns about conflict between security, potentially, and civil liberties. With all that, as you look out since Sunday with this high alert at the time of year when no one wants to hear it, what's on your mind? How do you feel about what you're seeing and hearing?
Well, Tom, the commission has been in existence since the end of 1998, got started in the beginning of 1999. The commission actually has reported now five times.
Mm-hmm.
By statute, we report every December the 15th. So we have done that every year, and we, in fact, completed our third report, and we're ready to go into business when the 9/11 attack occurred.
Right.
And then the Congress extended the commission two additional years. And one of my thoughts about this, I'll be happy, to, of course, to discuss with your listeners the essential points of the report. But with respect to this this threat this weekend, you know, first of all, I think the responsible thing to do is to alert state and local officials, to incorporate them appropriately into the national response and watch type plans that we have. I do believe that that you have to take certain steps because that's the responsible thing to do. If an attack occurred and nobody was put on alert anywhere, then I think the American people would be justifiable in saying, well, you know, what's wrong with you? How come you knew these things and you didn't take any kind of action? But at the same time, we should not be unrealistic about this. The entire United States of America is vulnerable because we are a free country. We're not going to lock down into some type of totalitarian system. And even if we did, we couldn't protect everything all the time.
Well, let me ask you then just your level of comfort or confidence this week. We're approaching Christmas Eve tomorrow. The orange alert is standing there. You've heard in this hour, and I'm sure you've read more extensively than we have, the kind of reports that are coming in. What's your level of confidence that if there's a serious threat somewhere out there, menacing the country, I guess we have to say, that it will be met, that it will be matched, that it will be prevented?
Yeah, you have to deal with it two ways. You have to deal with it in terms of prevention, and then if you're unsuccessful in preventing, then you have to be prepared to appropriately respond and to circumscribe the challenge. And where I was really headed on this, Tom, is this. The only way in the long run that we can really get on top of this is through improved intelligence, through working with the Central Intelligence Agency, domestic intelligence organizations, sharing of information, making sure that you incorporate in the information obtained from the states and the locals and get information back down into their hands. Only good intelligence gives you the ability to actually meet the enemy before they actually strike. And then in addition to that, of course, we have to have the states and the locals into a comprehensive national plan to be prepared to respond. Because if an attack occurs and you circumscribe it, then that actually is a victory here in the United States. So we have to be prepared to do both.
And as you listen to the menu of potential targets that Josh Meyer has laid out for us tonight and many have laid out over the last few days, They're serious. I mean, they're places that could have, in major urban centers, but also around the country, major fuel depots, chemical plants, and nuclear plants and so on. One of the warnings that you brought up in your report, Governor Gilmore, was about this tension between defense against terrorism and concern for civil liberties. When the threat rises high, how are you able to hang on to that concern for civil liberties?
Well, that's actually a great question, and it's a central one for the commission, and I certainly will address it. But let me say two things. Number one, you have to look at the capability of the enemy, not what you can dream up that they could do, some bridge off someplace in some remote location or something of this nature, because, quite frankly, any attack successfully made in the United States will affect our economy because of the instantaneous information that will go out about it nationwide. So you have to address the fact that the enemy may not have the capability of getting at some bridge someplace or some national monument. You have to look and see what they're actually able to do.
Are you then downplaying the reports of credible threats to such sites?
Well, I don't have the information to know whether it's credible or not.
But we don't want to see them as supermen, and we grant that. Absolutely.
No, you don't. You have to understand what they're able to do. And when, for example, there's very little information that says that a true weapon of mass destruction is in the hands of the enemy and could be delivered into this country. A conventional attack, yes, our commission said that a conventional attack in this country was inevitable. We said that in the year 2000. But on the other hand, we have to remember one very important point, and that is that we cannot allow people who might attack us in the homeland and use the ability to use our freedoms against ourselves and to actually deliver an attack to upset the entire apple cart of the values of the American people. We are free, confident, solid people, world leaders, but above all things, committed to the liberties of the individual within this nation. And we can't allow the enemy, because they can do something reckless in this country, to upset the entire system of the way we think as Americans. And so we just have to be prepared to deal with this. We put the proper systems in place. The Department of Homeland Security is doing a good job. There's a lot more to be done. Our commission has said that. We've made recommendations on improvement. But we have to put our systems in place and then get on with our lives as confident people. You know, there's always been dangers in this country, always. In the history of the entire nation, there have always been dangers and risks. This is not different now.
Well, it sure looked different on 9/11/2001, and it feels a bit different today with the range of potential targets and the kind of unorthodox attacks that we witnessed on 9/11.
I am not downplaying the horror of the attacks that occurred either in New York City or in Virginia at the Pentagon, and a lot of people died, and I certainly visited a lot of victims in the hospitals.
Sure you did.
But have we not had major catastrophes in this country, both by enemy forces and lunatics like people in Oklahoma City, and also by natural catastrophes.
Yes, we have.
We have to be prepared to deal with it.
Former Virginia Governor James Gilmore, we're glad you're with us. Josh Meyer, I want to turn to you for a moment. Governor Gilmore was speaking to the limits of terrorists' capacity to inflict attacks. What are you hearing about that? I mean, we look at what they did with two airplanes or a few airplanes and think, gosh, there's almost nothing that couldn't be done. But, of course, that's not true. But how real are the limits?
The limits to what we can do to stop them?
No, the limits to their capacity to execute attacks.
Well, I mean, I think they're limited in some cases by technology, by organization, and by many other factors. I mean, clearly our efforts – to put al-Qaeda on the run have been very successful. It's now, instead of a sort of a top-down organizational structure with a command and control centralized unit and then, you know, far-flung cells around the world, I think it's now much more of a decentralized group.
But does that matter? You say it's very successful, and yet we're on orange alert.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, it depends on who you ask about that. I mean, September 11th was essentially 19 soldiers or people in this country with some help from the outside. A lot of other major attacks have been even less, fewer people. And what really has authorities concerned is that if you had a biological or a chemical attack, that you could even do it with just one or two people. The question is, or a nuclear attack, the question is whether or not they have that capability right now. A lot of people from our FBI Director Robert Mueller on down, you know, have said publicly that if they believe that if they have had that capability, that they would have used it by now.
And ironically, we're still looking back at airplanes as a potential target, specific intelligence this time out.
Right. And, you know, I mean, the traditional definition of terrorism is to terrorize a large group of people in far more greater proportion than the people that are actually affected by the act. And so, I mean, I know a lot of FBI officials that are absolutely terrified of the potential for somebody walking into a crowded mall or, you know, an address by a presidential candidate and blowing themselves up like they do in Israel. I mean, that would only take one person, maybe a couple of people to do it. And we could put all the resources in the world, you know, at this problem and spend, you know, many, many more billions of dollars than we already have. And what has them concerned is that Al-Qaeda is watching carefully at what we're doing and trying to sort of poke holes or find the holes in the Homeland Security net. I mean, the border with Canada is you know, 3,000 or 4,000 miles long.
It's long and it's porous. Way. David Heyman, you've gone through some pretty elaborate kind of strategic gaming of how these warnings play out, how threats play out. You had one called Silent Vector with some fairly prominent people involved, including Governor James Gilmore with us tonight, Sam Nunn, James Wolseley, Wesley Clark, even D.D. Myers, playing roles as if they were the top echelons of the federal government and a serious threat comes in. And you looked closely at that. You played the game through very seriously and came away with some key lessons. I wish you would share some of those with us.
Yes, and I would add that the governor played himself very well.
No doubt.
We did this exercise back in 2002 called Silent Vector, and I would say that despite the many areas of improvement today, there is still no concrete way to solve the central problem of Homeland Security that we identified with this exercise, which is how does the government warn citizens and undertake prudent protective measures mm-hmm. when the precise nature and timing of a potential attack is unknown? We created a tabletop exercise, National Security Council, with the people you mentioned. The exercise simulated a 2-day or 4-day actual event.
Almost seemed to simulate what we're up against right now.
Exactly. It was basically the players were faced with the possibility of a highly likely but inherently ambiguous terrorist threat. And the first question that they had to ask themselves is the threat credible in light of the shallow intelligence? The second is, if it is credible, what are the terrorists likely to attack? Should the priorities be? What are the protective measures you put in place? And initially, this National Security Council decided that it was too vague and imprecise to take concrete steps. So instead, what they did, exactly what we're doing today, the president ordered a general elevation of the color-coded threat advisory system.
Right.
And this step raises a bunch of issues.
One of them being that along with that comes a cascade of reporting about things that are not entirely firm, that may be potential fears or problems. You say one key lesson is that when governments can't say exactly what's happening, rumors become facts.
That's true. And the challenge then is when does the government inform the public of what's credible, what information they have, and when do they keep it to themselves? The question also is when do they inform the governors, the states, the local officials? When do they involve the private sector? The problem is that our threat advisory system is really designed for a generic notification or advice.
This is only the color code we're in the middle of right now.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's required for the federal government. It's advisory to the state and local officials. It's completely voluntary, though, for the state officials, for local officials, and for the private sector, which owns the critical infrastructure.
And here's one of the funny contradictions in it or difficulties. There's an ambiguous warning that you concluded was essential to give, but you said the warning itself helps terrorists achieve their goals. Play that out.
Well, that's true, because if, in fact, you know, we go up to a level orange and nothing happens, and as we talked about earlier, there's a tremendous cost and burden economically mm-hmm. To folks who are going up at that level. The terrorists have partially achieved their goals, depending upon what kind of protective measures we put in place.
And you call that cheap terrorism. They don't even have to do anything. Just put out a lot of hot emails.
Well, it's possible that they could do that. One of the things, though, to bear in mind is since 9/11, our intelligence has gotten far better than it was back then. This year, we are gradually able to infiltrate networks. Our human intelligence is better. Our targeting is better. And so as the time goes forward, we as a country become stronger in ability to interdict the terrorist networks.
James Gilmore, I want to bring you in here. You were there playing the governor of Virginia, the role that you have filled alongside Sam Nunn, who was playing the president in this exercise, Wesley Clark playing chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, even Dede Meyers back as the president's press secretary. But I'm sure you all took it seriously. It was very much like what we're in the midst of right now. What did you come away from this exercise thinking?
Well, we all took it very seriously, and I thought that the people who played the federal roles were obviously very able people who had great experience. But my role was to play the governor of Virginia. And since I actually had been the governor of Virginia, I was very conscious of the power that I had. Mm-hmm. And the role that I played was to be deferential to the president in a time of national crisis, but to not surrender my authority as governor of Virginia and to take certain actions as necessary to fulfill my duties as governor. And that what that highlights is you must bring the governors and the localities, the key localities, into play. And if your intelligence organizations indicate to you that the attack is most likely in a particular way, mm-hmm. you have to tell the governor that, and you have to tell the mayors that, that are directly affected. We have recommended in our commission report that perhaps we need a more flexible type of warning system that is a little more tailored to the actual intelligence involved. But we place great emphasis on the absolute necessity of sharing information with the states and locals.
And what about when the window of warning passes, you know, if the steps taken were effective, as the conclusions come out here, there's no attack. And then silence creates this ambiguous situation. Was it successful, or was it all a hoax in the first place? That's hard for a country, for security officials, James Gilmore, to deal with time after time.
Well, that's why we have to have a great communication with the American people. We have to tell them that total security is not possible. We have to tell them that genuine measures are being taken based upon genuine information. Earlier in the report, there was some discussion, gee, are we being played here?
Mm-hmm.
We better not be played here, and I don't think we are being played here. I think the people right. who have the responsibility to do this take this responsibility very, very seriously. But you can't rule out psychological operations or psychological warfare against us by the enemy. You know, we just have to include the American people in the discussion and let them know how ambiguous this is. But in the end, real leadership here means that we have to tell the American people that these crises and these threats are not going to change the character of the way that we are. We have to recognize the vulnerabilities and get on with our lives and and work towards the best possible result that we can.
Josh Meyer, I wonder how high up the security chain your contacts were who were not sleeping last weekend because of the seriousness of these current threats.
Very high. In fact, I think it was in our story today. I can't remember what actually made the final version or not, but I know that John Ashcroft had just left Thursday to go back to Missouri for the holiday break, and he was flown back on Saturday pretty much right afterwards. I mean, they're taking this very seriously. And
they've got some specific knowledge. They must have that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like, you know, I've spent the last couple of days talking to people about the elephant in the middle of the room, which is, you know, you're not telling me something here. All the people that I usually deal with are much more concerned this time than they seem like they've ever been before. And so either I'm trying to figure out if it's that they're not telling me something they know or that they aren't telling me something that they don't know.
And so there's the tension. You have to kind of raise the flag, but then you can't say everything. We've got to take a short break here. We'll be right back. We're talking with David Heyman, former Governor James Gilmore, and Josh Meyer. We're looking at what's going on behind the orange alert. How do we judge? How much reaction to threats is too much? How much is too little? How much is just right? And what is your level of confidence that spectacular acts of terrorism can be stopped? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about what's going on behind the orange alert, about the alarming holiday terror threat and details of the national response. Our guest tonight, former Virginia Governor James Gilmore. He's head of the Gilmore Commission, which has been looking at terror and terror preparedness in the United States, just reporting in last week with another big report there. David Heyman, Director of Homeland Security, the Homeland Security Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, joining us from Washington. And also Josh Meyer covers terrorism for the Los Angeles Times and joins us from Washington. You can join us as well. How are you processing the latest high alert on terror? How do you take on reports of government officials wigging out over the current terror threat level? And are you letting the orange alert seep into your holiday conversations, take over your family dinner table? How are you dealing with it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Ann's calling from Boston. Hi, Ann. You're on the air.
you?
Very well, thanks.
Good. I just feel that, you know, raising the alert system is very counterproductive because it makes us people who have no power and who have no ability to make any difference, really, edgy. And, you know, and every time that we suspect something, we're calling 911 or, you know, that's going to clog up the system. So I think the best thing for the administration to do is to be very specific to us, give us 2 days warning by fixing, you know, the old tornado sirens. And if they feel something is coming up, you know, to put those sirens on, so at least I know I can do something, which is go to my basement or something. I don't know.
But, Ann, maybe they're being as specific as they can. And the window is certainly not that long here. They're not saying months from now. They're saying that there's a threat. It's real and it's now.
Well, if it's real, then what am I supposed to do about it? Don't tell me about it. I mean, I think the best thing to do is to, you know, have a system where you communicate with the law officers and the law enforcement agencies so that they know about it and they're more vigilant. Hire more, you know, intelligence in the local community. Spend the resources in different ways. But if you tell me, what am I supposed to do? Not, you know, there's very little that I can do.
Right. You still got to go out and get the groceries. And we've got it. And thanks for your call. David Heyman, how do you respond to that citizen view?
Well, I think that's one of the challenges today because the threat advisory system is really an advisory system for state and local officials to enhance the protective measures. It's nothing but a warning to private citizens that we're in an enhanced situation. The problem, and if you're still listening, is that today's threat environment, we will not know in advance, probably, in all likelihood, where or when a terrorist attack will occur, but we'll know generally that we're in an enhanced situation. And the reason that it's important for private citizens to understand is because if they start hearing rumors from all of the different people who will be involved in the protective measures...
Which they would if all the local police know something's going
exactly,
on.
Exactly. That could be more counterproductive, so that if everybody hears up front, it at least allows us to understand the situation, number one. Number two, there are things that private citizens should do, in fact, to the extent that you prepare for Isabel. Hurricane Isabel came up the coast earlier, East Coast in America earlier this year, and we knew it in advance. We knew approximately three or four days out that there was something going on, and people went to the stores and they put a stock of food together, and things like that are similar to what you should do in a terrorist incident, just to prepare, you know, where your family is going to be, what your communication strategy is in case there's an incident. But the last thing I just want to say to people who are thinking about this is that we as a nation need to understand better that this is a changed reality, that we're going to be in it for a while. And understanding threats, understanding how to respond needs to become part of the fabric of our lives. And it's one of those things that it's going to take some time to understand. It's not pleasant to go through these raising and lowering of the alert levels. But it is important that we get used to it and we learn how to deal with it in a productive and safe way.
James Gilmore, is there a way to hone the threat level system so that it might be somehow less ambiguous, more useful? What have you found in looking at the terrorism threat scene?
Well, first of all, I thought that David summed it up very, very well there. And our commission has talked about a new normalcy, trying to understand the rules of the game that we're in here. And communicating that to the American people, like Ann, for example, in her comment, was saying, well, gee, you know, what do you expect me to do? And the short answer is we don't expect you to do anything. We expect you to be aware that there is a condition that the government is dealing with, that there, in fact, could be something that occurs. You ought to think ahead what your response would be if you suddenly turn on the television and see that something is going on somewhere. And then get on with life and begin to understand that we are in a situation now where the new normalcy means that we understand that we get as prepared as we can get, that we incorporate in a national plan, we make sure that the states and locals are fully integrated, we improve our intelligence and share that with our state and local people, we look to the capabilities of the enemy and try to thwart that, and then we get on with our lives. We cannot live forever in a state of frazzlement, or the enemy will have achieved a great victory.
And what about Ann's point, then? If there's not a lot she can do immediately, why not just let the government deal with it and leave her out of this cycle?
David summed that up very well. The American people would expect their government to at least inform them what they're doing. In fact, you asked a specific question, which was, what can we do? I think that we should give as much information as we can to the American people as to what we really think is going on. And you know, clue them in.
And there's a very real sense in which we're all in this together. Dan is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Hi. You know, it's often said that we live in divided times in this country, and I would just like to say that in the event of another attack, I will surely be looking to share love and compassion with every human being around me, irregardless of, you know, our partisan inclinations. And I'm very concerned about what I see is gross negligence as far as our national security goes. You know, the 9/11 Commission has been burdened with a series of obstacles trying to analyze what happened on 9/11. The chemical industry has been allowed simply to regulate itself as regards security, despite Tom Ridge himself recognizing the need for federal regulation. And this industry doesn't even have to report the measures they've taken to the federal government. There are 123 chemical manufacturing and storage sites, which, if jeopardized by explosives, could kill upwards of a million citizens.
So you're saying we still aren't doing everything that ought to be done, that we can recognize ought to be done. Let me put that to my guests, and thank you for your call, Dan. Josh Meyer, how about it? At this point, you must follow all the views of what's going on and what's not. What's the gap between optimal security and where we stand right now? Is there a gap? How big?
Well, there's probably huge gaps and many gaps. Somebody, it might have been the former governor, just mentioned something about the new normal, which I think is a very good point. I was just in Israel, and I can tell you that the citizens there act a lot differently than they do here, and because they're used to at least 20 years of attacks, terrorist attacks, within their midst.
But what about specific gaps that may still be there? Congressman Ed Markey has been critical of the administration in the last couple of days because commercial cargo on planes is still not physically screened.
Right.
He's saying the Bush administration inexplicably and, in my view, recklessly continues to routinely allow unscreened and unknown cargo onto passenger planes. There's a gap. What else? Chemical plants?
Cargo ships. I mean, even if you screened every cargo that comes into the United States, which would be virtually impossible, you still can't tell where it's coming from, whether you know, there's a discussion about whether to tag it at the beginning, and so you can sort of trace the whole shipment from one point to another. You know, but you could offload it at one point along the way. Like I said, the border with Canada is almost impossible to shore up. There's 18 or 19 different watch lists that all the various government agencies are keeping, and those have yet to be reconciled. I mean, there's probably many, many dozens of gaps in the system right now. You know, that you could exploit if you're Al-Qaeda or other terrorist groups.
David Heyman, let me put the same question to you. Of course, you can't make a country impermeable. You can't do everything. Some things are economically unfeasible, but of the things that are feasible, our caller raised chemical plants and the private companies' potential to do more around security. There's the cargo issue. Of the feasible things that might be done but are not, what would you point to?
Well, look, I could actually go through a list. There's a tremendous amount of vulnerability still in the system, and there's a tremendous amount of preparedness that we could improve upon. And there's a number of reports from both from the government, the GAO, to private institutions like my own that have looked at that question. I think there's a more fundamental question mm-hmm. that we need to answer, and that is, how do we set priorities in this country? Because there's so many: chemical, biological, nuclear, radiological. These are the kinds of threats that we face today, and we face them across critical infrastructure, across multitudes of cities, some big, some small.
Well, do we have to set priorities? I mean, can't we address chemical and nuclear, let's say, at the same time? Those look pretty big.
Well, the grand challenge is, how do we make sure that we ensure that we are protected and we have strong security at the same time that we do not spend ourselves to death? The chances are that we could address all of the threats and all of the vulnerabilities, mm-hmm. which are seemingly pervasive and ubiquitous, and spend all of our capital on that at the expense of our economy and weakening our own economic security. So we need to look at, how do we set priorities in this country? The other piece we need to look at is answering the question, what is enough? How do we know when we're prepared? If we are going to continue to address solutions to the priorities we pick, we need to know when we've done the best we can. Now, we're never going to be fully prepared, of course, but we do need to have some standards out there or some design basis for which we build our response.
But again, to our caller's base question, how close are we, 2 years plus after 9/11, to where we ought to be? Are there artificial constraints on what's being done? Should the chemical industry just be told, hey, you implement this security measures around your plants, period, just do it?
Well, the question is then, who pays for that? Does the chemical industry pay for it? Does the federal government pay for that? Is it a combination? Is it a shared, you know, there's some policy questions in that that we need to address. The answer is that we need to improve our security on a multitude of platforms.
And there's limits to what can be afforded.
And so you have to make choices in this country. We cannot.
If I can get in here.
Governor Gilmore, sure.
I want to be sure that your listeners are aware that our commission reports can be read on the RAND Corporation webpage, rand.org, RAND.org. Mm-hmm. And when the search vehicle comes up, just type in Gilmore Commission and all these reports will come up and to be seen by your listeners. Because one thing we've done in this last report is, and in confirmation of some of the things we just said, is we do believe that there has to be a more comprehensive national strategy laid out, some priorities and some ability to set priorities so that we can decide how much should be spent, how much is enough, and what should be spent properly. I think that those comments are exactly correct. And we think that you have to do that specifically and absolutely in line with the civil freedoms of this country, not fall into a trade-off type of mentality. Once you get into trade-offs, the enemy just keeps driving up anxiety until all of our civil freedoms disappear.
So hang on to them even as it's being addressed. David's calling from Melrose, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Good evening. Thank you.
Sure.
I've been listening to and reading about all the Code Orange alerts and mm-hmm. the various dangers. And here in Boston, the mayor of the city is trying to delay the entry of a liquid natural gas tanker into
a huge tanker full of highly combustible liquid natural gas. Yep.
Exactly. And I have a sister-in-law who's flying into to Logan from Central America or South America tomorrow, and my mm-hmm. parents are flying out of the city to Europe on New Year's Day.
I'm sure a lot of listeners can relate to exactly the vulnerability you feel there.
Yeah, and I'm just feeling very angry about the situation that we're in. I mean, I feel like this administration has wasted our time and resources, military resources, and $87 billion on fighting this war in Iraq, and not going after the chief source of potential terrorism, which is al-Qaeda. And on top of that, we still haven't directed resources towards rebuilding Afghanistan, or we're still being, there's still warlords in charge of that country.
So when you look at priorities, you look at the global foreign policy picture as well. Our time is running down, David, but thanks for your call. David Heyman, let me put that to you. At CSIS, you must look at the whole picture. What do you think of the balance of effort here? In strict terrorism prevention terms, has Iraq been a good investment?
Well, let me answer the broader question about whether we're secure today as a nation. And I think to do that analysis, you have to look at our national security is a composite of economic security, of homeland security, of our ability to influence in the world, the sort of the capital of America in terms of diplomacy. And across those various areas, one can do their analysis. And at the end of the day, it gets back to our priorities. Where do you want to invest our scarce resources that we have here in America?
That may be the broader question, but we only have half a minute left. Go to the specific point. Has Iraq been a good investment given the priorities that you would suggest?
Well, in terms of the counterterrorism question, it's not at all clear that there's a linkage between to the al-Qaeda network and Saddam Hussein in terms of the way that it was originally cast in the debate. So I would argue that if you're looking at specific counterterrorism, that would probably not have been your first choice.
And Josh Meyer, a quick last question to you. How much longer do you expect the orange alert to be up? Do you have any idea?
At least several weeks, I'm told, maybe even longer.
Oh, boy. Here we go. Josh Meyer, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
You're welcome, Tom.
Josh Meyer covers terrorism for the Los Angeles Times. And former Governor of Virginia, James Gilmore, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure to talk to everybody in your listening audience.
And David Heyman in Washington, Director of the Homeland Security Project for the Center for Strategic and International Studies, thanks for coming on.
Thanks. Be safe. Happy holidays.
The same to you. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.